Hello there. Today is Tuesday, November the 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, impeachment hearings could be even more impactful this week as the House of Representatives holds live televised hearings to the public.
The public ought to be able to see exactly what happens. I think it's a good idea to make the hearings public, and people will then have to make their decisions.
A warning from Hong Kong officials as unusual weekday protests turn extremely violent. Also ahead, a popular singer is using her celebrity in an unusual way to fight climate change. It's all on today's International Edition. As we said, this could be a very pivotal week for the Democratic-led impeachment inquiry. There will be publicly televised testimony starting Wednesday. It follows closed-doors depositions at the Capitol, during which witnesses were questioned about whether Trump asked Ukraine to investigate the family of former vice president and political rival Joe Biden, who is seeking the Democratic Party's nomination in next year's presidential election. We get more now from AP correspondent Rita Foley.
The president broke the law.
Democrat Jackie Speier is on the House Intelligence Committee, which will conduct the hearings.
This is a very strong case of bribery.
But Republican Congressman Mac Thornberry of Texas says,
I believe it was inappropriate. I do not believe it was impeachable.
The president's accused of withholding military aid to Ukraine while asking it to investigate political rival Joe Biden and his family. Both members of Congress were on ABC's This Week. Rita Foley, Washington.
Well, all three witnesses this week, top Ukrainian diplomat William Taylor, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, and former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch. And all three of them, in their closed-door depositions last month, expressed concerns about President Trump's efforts. President Trump spoke at an opening ceremony at the New York City Veterans Day Parade Monday as the nation paid tribute to the men and women who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces, and many paid the ultimate price. As the first sitting U.S. president to attend the parade and lay a wreath at the Eternal Light Memorial, Trump talked about the warriors in attendance dating back to World War II.
Thanks to American warriors, al-Baghdadi is dead. His second in charge is dead. We have our eyes on number three. His reign of terror is over, and our enemies are running very, very scared.
The president touted the successes of taking the number one and two leaders out. His remarks brought applause from the crowd, but some people nearby did not give Trump a warm welcome back to his native city. According to the Los Angeles Times reporter Eli Stokels, quote, as Trump's voice boomed from the loudspeakers, chants of lock him up could be heard coming from the crowd. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence laid a wreath in honor of U.S. veterans at Arlington National Cemetery.
Today, all across America, in gatherings large and small, in cities and towns, we pause to remember all those who served in uniform and did come home. It is Veterans Day in America.
And with the nation stopping to remember all of America's service members, a new book, Wounded Charity, talks about the nation's largest veteran charity, the Wounded Warrior Project, which was at the center of a 2016 controversy that accused the organization's leadership of mismanaging funds. The media damaging reports cost the charity a fall of $200 million in revenue. But as we hear from Doug White, former director of Columbia University's master's program of nonprofit fundraising, the explosive accusations were, according to him, unfounded. White did extensive research on the matter, which ultimately led to documentation for a new book, Wounded Charity. Mr. White, thank you for being with us. We know that many of the nation's veterans come home wounded in some way or another, whether it's physical wounds or emotional wounds. How did you come to this investigation of the charity to begin with?
A volunteer called me and said that the stories on CBS and in the New York Times just did not add up. And at the time, I was prone to think that those stories were pretty accurate. I spent a lot of my time studying organizations that do badly, organizations that are charities and are supposed to do good for their communities but don't. And so I like to sniff those out. And this seemed like another example of that. But this volunteer said, this is not the organization I know. And I was asked to call the organization, the CEO and the COO, and I did. And they confirmed their feelings were that this was not the organization that they were running. And would I come down and do a little bit of a research project on this? I never did that because they were fired before too long. But the questions remained, especially after an investigation was done initially that said that the allegations were incorrect. But they were fired anyway, and so the mystery even grew. And I was going to use this as a case study in one of my classes, but I got so involved with it, I got so impassioned with the mystery that I just turned it into a full-time project, a three-year project, and wanted to find out what happened. And it turned out that the allegations were wrong and that the organization suffered big time from the incorrect allegations. Over the following 3 years, the organization lost over $600 million from what it would have raised had there been no allegations.
The organization's leadership was accused of mismanaging funds. What exactly does that mean? Were they talking about illegal activity or just carelessness, or what were the accusations specifically?
The accusations were about misspending money or improperly spending money on having too much fun. The biggest one was going to a conference in Colorado where the entire staff was brought together, some hundreds of people. And the accusation was that this was all wasted money. It was all going to booze and parties and frolicking away. And none of that was true.
Where did this all come from, though? Where did the accusations, how did they evolve?
There was a group that formed itself on Facebook, a group of former employees who were disgruntled. All of them were fired for cause, or some left. But they were finding the audience for the accusations, and they just grew. And they found themselves in basically an echo chamber. And then the New York Times and CBS picked up on that echo chamber. And because it's a salacious story in a sense, because it's a charity, it's the largest charity, it's a veterans charity. These are all heartstring ideas. And so anything going wrong at an organization like this, you want to be on top of it. And on that count, I totally agree. And by the way, I have a high reverence for both CBS and the New York Times. It's just that in this particular case, they really blew it. And they listened to the wrong people. They listened only to the people who were complaining. They did not do their investigation very well. They don't understand the way charities are run, and they blew the story. Simple.
And as you just mentioned, that really impacted their future revenue.
You have over $600 million, and people might stop at that number and say, oh my gosh, that's a lot of money. And it is. But the real problem, as I see it, is that there are so many veterans and their families who are not going to be helped because of that lack of money. There was a trust that was established that was to have had $1 billion put into it over the next several years to take care of these young men and women for their lifetimes. Because they come back, as you were saying earlier, damaged, either psychologically or physically. They need help. These people, they put themselves into harm's way for you and me, for all of us. And then when they come back, the Veterans Administration just doesn't have the ability to deal with all of these things. And so that's why these charities spring up, and veterans organizations around the country are trying to help them. And Wounded Warrior Project is one of the best and one of the biggest. So when you think about how much money is not being raised as a result of this travesty, translate that into the number of veterans and their families who will not get the help that they really need.
After your investigating and writing the book as a result, have the media outlets that originally reported the mismanagement of funds by Wounded Warrior Project, did they retract? Did they change? Did they update? Did they make any sort of attempt to report what you uncovered?
After several queries, I got no answer. There was no retraction. There was no re-explanation. There was nothing. And I have facts in my hands. I mean, I did the research here. This book is meant to be that retraction, quite frankly, and it's meant to be a powerful one to show that this organization is a good one. And it still is, by the way. I don't fault the new leadership for anything. I do believe the organization has a lesser vision than it used to. It's not going to be as big an organization. It's not going to do as many programs with as much robustness as it used to. But it's a good organization, and it's still the largest VSO, Veteran Service Organization, in the United States. The book itself is meant to correct that story, and I hope people will read it and be able to see how important not only the veterans organizations are, but also the reporting about charities in general, because we tend to not understand charities as well as we should.
Anything else you'd like to add on this Veterans Day?
Through it all, this was about veterans. And I say in my author's note, veterans are America's treasure. Without their service and that of their fallen comrades, who knows? The consequences to the nation would be unthinkable. It's important on this most solemn of days to think of the people who have given their lives and who have come home wounded on behalf of all of us.
All right. Well, that is Doug White. He's a former director of Columbia University's master's program on nonprofit fundraising and the author of the new book, Wounded Charity. Thank you so much for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Turkey has deported a U.S. citizen in its push to repatriate IS fighters. The U.S. applauds the resignation of the Bolivian president. The U.N. says uranium has been found at an undeclared site in Iran. And Boeing says its MAX 737 involved in two deadly plane crashes should be ready to resume commercial flights in January. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Hong Kong riot police fired tear gas at a university campus Tuesday, a day after a protester was shot and a man set on fire in some of the worst violence to rock the Chinese-ruled city in more than 5 months of anti-government demonstrations. The protester shot by police is in critical condition. It was caught on video and has been distributed to media outlets. And while officials say the incident is under investigation, chief executive for Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, speaking to reporters, defended the officer's actions and warned that continued violence would not be tolerated.
If there is still any wishful thinking that by escalating violence, the Hong Kong SAR government will yield to pressure to satisfy the so-called political demands, I'm making this statement clear and loud here. That will not happen.
The incidents marked a dramatic escalation in tensions, with riot police deployed to metro stations, some railway services suspended, and roads closed across the Asian financial hub for a second day, with long traffic jams in the middle of morning rush hour. Police said they had arrested about 260 people on Monday, bringing the total number to more than 3,000 since the protests escalated in June. My colleague Steve Miller spoke to reporter Justin Solomon Monday in Hong Kong about the protesters' shooting and the other violent incidents.
It started at 7 a.m. local time this morning. So protesters had called for a general strike, and they've done this before. They tried to stop transportation, tried to encourage people not to go to work. And this morning, they were out in these pockets and very much in cat and mouse, where they would just appear randomly. And at one location this morning, around 7:15 in the morning, protesters were setting up a roadblock and clashed with a traffic police officer. And that officer drew his service weapon. And in video, you can see a protester reach for that weapon. And the officer fired three shots in total. One of them hit the protester. The other two were not sure where those went. And the protester was taken to the hospital. He is recovering with non-life-threatening injuries. Now, later in the morning, a police officer on a motorcycle was videotaped doing circles around protesters, at one point appearing to run over several of them. In a press conference later in the day, the police came out and said that officer from the motorcycle incident has been suspended from frontline duties and that they'll be investigating it. Now, there's two other incidents in the day. Another one happened later in the morning where protesters lit a man on fire. They threw a chemical on him and lit that on fire, and he reportedly has suffered second-degree burns on 30% of his body. And another big incident in the day happened at around lunchtime in central Hong Kong, And Central, you can think of it as sort of the Wall Street of Hong Kong, where all of the financial headquarters are and all of these bankers go to work every day. And around lunchtime, when everybody was out, it was a beautiful day, protesters started and all of the workers started to join in when they went out for their lunch break. And the police fired tear gas in central Hong Kong. Many people in suits and ties were victim of that tear gas. And they quickly tried to disperse into some of these luxurious shopping malls in central Hong Kong to escape the tear gas. And it was quite a scene to see, where you have regular protesters in their normal black clad outfits that they've been wearing, and just regular Joes that are going to work or having their lunch and got caught up in this and really didn't mean to.
You just described a myriad of activity, but I want to focus for a second on the shooting, because the police have said there is an investigation going into that incident, although they did defend the officer's actions. But what's been the reaction to people in Hong Kong, especially among the protesters who saw this happen, who, you know, shared the video?
The reaction to the shooting in Hong Kong is similar to what we've been hearing and seeing for other incidents, not shooting related, but incidents involving the police, which is the police took it a step or two too far. The protester was unarmed, and that the police overreacted and they did not need to use a firearm in the incident. And truthfully, what will happen now is there will be more retaliation, more protest to this particular incident because of it.
What's that going to do to everything that's going on in Hong Kong? Because Chief Executive Carrie Lam came out and said the violence needs to stop escalating. The escalation of violence is not going to change the SAR's government position. So what's going to happen?
Well, you're sort of at a standstill, I suppose, where, you know, the protesters want change. The government says we can't do this change, and violence is certainly not going to help. But in the protesters' minds, when there is violence on the end of the police, like the shooting that we saw today, they will retaliate with their own sort of violence. That might be more roadblocks, more petrobombs, more bricks and rocks throwing at the police when police come out to stop these protests as they happen.
Justin Solomon is a reporter based in Hong Kong. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that was Steve Miller, my colleague with International Edition, speaking to reporter Justin Solomon in Hong Kong. Zimbabwe's central bank says it has Monday started circulating new lower denomination banknotes and coins, a move it says will help end shortages of cash and another step toward fully restoring a domestic currency after ending a decade of dollarization. Economists say the new notes will not end Zimbabwe shortages as the country production levels are still low. But as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare for VOA, the new money had not been delivered to banks by close of business on Monday.
By close of business Monday, most banks in Harare did not have the allocations of the new money. The Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe said it would comment once it has ensured that deliveries have been made to all banks. Harare resident Kudakwache Muchena is one of those tired of the cash shortages that have made life difficult for Zimbabweans over the past 2 years. He thinks the government needs to do more to boost confidence in the domestic currency known as the bond note after a decade of using US dollars and South African rand.
As a country, Zimbabwe needs its own currency, which can be used to transact locally and internationally. But I think there's been very little in terms of conscientizing the users of the currency in terms of building trust and understanding the need for a local currency.
Zimbabwe abandoned its own currency in 2008 due to extreme hyperinflation. The new currency faces an uphill climb as it does not trade beyond the country's borders and has lost value since being introduced in June. Nonetheless, Harare resident Larry Quirirai hopes the new currency succeeds.
In principle, of course, it's a good idea to have our own currency, but as always with many things in Zimbabwe, it will come down to policy consistency and that sort of thing, especially around the monetary and fiscal policy, and also coming up with a budget. What's the budget going to say? There are many questions around it, because the currency will have to be supported by production, and that's where the big thing is. And the success or lack of success of it is underpinned by the success outside the currency itself.
Zimbabwe's economy has struggled for two decades amid political turmoil and government policies widely seen as unfriendly to farm production and foreign investment. Clinton Musonza, an economist at the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe, says the country's cash shortages are far from being over.
The coming in of new notes is not going to end all the cash problems in Zimbabwe per se, because you have to understand that the challenges that Zimbabwe is facing are emanating from the production side. So if, as long as we are not producing enough, we are going to be in this kind of situation for long.
Musonza says lower denomination bond notes will improve the availability of cash, but notes that the government would prefer to see Zimbabwe become what it calls cash light. Since the cash shortage started, the central government has encouraged Zimbabweans to conduct transactions electronically. But many businesses still insist on hard money in exchange for goods and services. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Authorities in Australia's Queensland and New South Wales states on Monday declared a state of emergency as the country's eastern region prepared for catastrophic fire conditions. Authorities say more than 150 homes have been destroyed. At least three people have died and some 30 have been injured. Officials are warning the number of people killed could rise as fire-hit areas are inspected. Phil Mercer has more.
The bushfire crisis spans two states in eastern Australia. Monstrous walls of flame have terrorised towns and villages. Many fires in northern New South Wales and parts of Queensland continue to burn out of control, despite a military-style firefighting effort. Waterbombing aircraft have doused them from above, while hundreds of firefighters, many of them volunteers, have gone into battle on the ground. The full impact on life and property could take days to emerge. Bridges, schools and power lines, as well as many homes, have been destroyed. Others are counting their luck.
I've come back and my house is still there. It's rammed earth and it's still there. I can't believe it. My sheds are all gone and my house is still there.
I'm still gathering thoughts, trying to remember that what it was that I actually did see, whether or not I could believe what I saw.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the nation won't forget those affected by the fires.
Those who have been so directly and horribly impacted by these fires, those who have lost loved ones and those who will learn they have lost loved ones in the not too distant future, those who have lost homes, those who are sitting in the smouldered ruins of properties that once stood, they are the ones that Australians will be thinking of today.
Hot and windy weather combined with a long drought have made parts of eastern Australia a tinderbox. Cooler conditions Sunday helped firefighters, but the danger in eastern Australia is far from over. Authorities say they're likely to issue extreme fire warnings for a vast section of the New South Wales coast on Tuesday, as well as for inland regions. Areas around Sydney are considered to be particularly at risk. Queensland is also bracing for more hazardous conditions. Residents have been warned that if they're threatened by fire, they may not get help. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Ecologists are urging creative solutions to clean up plastic waste, choking waterways, and threatening ecosystems across the globe. The United Nations Children's Fund partnered with a Colombian company to turn piles of plastic into the building blocks of education in Africa. VOA's Arash Arabasadi takes us to the school.
Not long ago, 114 students had nowhere to study.
It was February and March. There was a strong wind followed by heavy rain. To our big surprise, when we woke up, the school collapsed.
Then, a new kind of building project took shape in the western Ivory Coast region of Sakassou.
UNICEF found me and said they'd heard of our difficulties and said they'd come out and build three classes for the children in our community with plastic bricks. I laughed.
Far from a joke, UNICEF partnered with a Colombian company called Conceptos Plásticos, or Plastic Concepts.
These classrooms are pretty strong, they are safe, they're water retardant, they're fire retardant, they're water resistant, and they as well last a longer period compared to normal traditional classrooms.
The building project takes discarded plastics and turns them into construction-grade bricks.
Plastic buildings? Okay, let's wait and see. And later on, the school just came out of the earth. I'm a living witness. That has given us hope.
The project may give hope to thousands of other children in Ivory Coast. Conceptos Plásticos is constructing an in-country factory to convert even more plastic into bricks.
Before we had bad construction, UNICEF came to build us this building. We like it.
UNICEF says Yamoussoukro, the capital city, produces more than 280 metric tons of plastic every day and recycles only about 5% of that. The Plastic Brick Project aims to build schools for more than 25,000 children and give jobs to women in low-income neighborhoods. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the University of Chicago found evidence that supports a link between exposure to environmental pollution and neuropsychiatric disorders such as bipolar disorder and depression. The researchers analyzed information from a U.S. health insurance database which contained neuropsychiatric disease claims for 151 million people. They then compared patient location information from the health insurance database to U.S. Environmental Protection Agency measurements taken in various U.S. localities of 87 potential air pollutants. According to the study, the U.S. counties with the worst air quality also had a 27% increase in bipolar disorder and a 6% increase in major depression compared to areas with the best air quality. The researchers were able to validate their U.S. findings by applying their methodology to data called from similar data sets in Denmark. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, singer Billie Eilish is teaming up with Global Citizens to take action for a more sustainable world. Her fans will be able to earn free tickets to her upcoming tour by helping to fight climate change. The pop star is set to head out on her Where Do We Go arena tour next year and will conclude with four shows at London's O2 Arena in July. And following the announcement of the dates, Eilish detailed how she plans to make the time on the road as eco-friendly as possible. Shows will feature a Billie Eilish eco-village, an area where fans can learn about climate change and the importance of making a difference. And she, as we said, has joined forces with Global Citizen to offer fans free tickets to tour through the organization's rewards platform. The more they do, the more they will earn free tickets to her tours. Eilish is a longtime vegan who has been also increasingly more outspoken about her concerns about the environment. You've been listening to International Edition. That's our show for today. We thank you for joining us. Thanks to Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Tony Pollack. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
My mommy likes to sing along with me, but she won't sing this song if she needs all the need to be still pity.
This is the